Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present James S. Henry, lead researcher on a new report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, who summarizes his investigation into how the super-rich around the world have avoided paying taxes on an estimated $21 trillion of hidden wealth. Dustin Steele, an organizer with the group Radical Action for Mountain People Survival, who discusses his group's ongoing campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. And Ted Lewis of Global Exchange, who talks about this summer's U.S. Caravan for Peace, which is calling for an end to the violence in Mexico produced by the war on drugs. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Argentina, the largest producer of natural gas in South America, sits on huge untapped reserves of shale gas, which can be extracted by hydraulic fracturing or fracking, the controversial process linked to water contamination in the United States. In April, Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner nationalized the majority of shares of YPF, the former state-run oil company, which was sold to Spanish oil firm Repsol in the late 1990s. Fernandez complained that the Spanish oil company was milking its profits from existing oil and gas operations and not investing in new energy production. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Argentina has the third highest potential for shale gas in the world behind the United States and China. The Argentine government has launched several studies of the potential of shale gas development. Fracking through shale rock in the United States uses industrial chemicals and highly pressurized water. Across the United States, charges have been leveled that the drilling technique has resulted in the contamination of groundwater. In Argentina, energy giants like ExxonMobil, Apache, and French-based Total are pushing to invest in shale gas projects. Argentine energy consultant Mariana Matranga told the Interpress service that fracking technology has only been in use for a short time in the world. It uses a significant amount of water, and the whole watershed needs to be monitored very carefully. It can be done well or done badly. A lot depends on how much is invested. The Consumer Financial Protection Board, or CFPB, created by the Dodd-Frank Banking Reform Law, launched its first major enforcement action in mid-July against credit card giant Capital One. The company agreed to pay $150 million back to customers for marketing services they did not need. Capital One also paid a $60 million fine. The $210 million award is just the first step for the CFPB in reining in abuses by credit card companies and non-bank financial institutions. Moreover, several big banks, including J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and HSBC, were sued by Hawaii's Attorney General for selling so-called add-on products to credit card customers. CFPB Director Richard Cordray won billions of dollars in settlements from Merrill Lynch and AIG when he previously served as Ohio's Attorney General. In its early days, the CFPB attracted key officials from the financial services industry who understood the metrics credit card companies used to market products to customers. Now the Bureau is using the same metrics to test-run new single-page disclosure forms as part of its Know Before You Owe campaign. Overall, the banking and credit card industry remains hostile to the CFPB, the brainchild of consumer advocate Elizabeth Warren, who is now running for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts. Super PACs unleashed by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling in late 2010 has led to a flood of secret money donated by billionaires in the 2012 election. Mother Jones magazine observed that over the last 40 years, covert campaign donations have led to several major political scandals dating back to Richard Nixon's re-election campaign in 1972. In the spring of 1972, the Nixon campaign was in a mad dash to collect secret money before new disclosure rules took effect. In a two-month blitz for campaign funds, the Nixon campaign raised $20 million, some of it delivered in cash on private jets. The Watergate scandal would lead to historic campaign finance reforms in 1974. 1974 was the high watermark for campaign reformers when a strong bipartisan majority approved spending and contribution limits and created a new agency with enforcement powers. The law was weakened by the Supreme Court a year later in the Buckley v. Valeo ruling, which struck down spending limits as unconstitutional and upheld the right of independent groups to spend unlimited sums of money on political campaigns. In early 2002, the McCain-Feingold law to ban soft money was passed by Congress and signed by President Bush. Not long after McCain-Feingold was enacted, conservative groups went on the offensive against campaign finance laws, which culminated in the Citizens United decision. Now, with a hostile Supreme Court, grassroots pressure is building for a movement for a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
This election year, one of the central debates between Democrats and Republicans, between President Obama and presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney, is over how much should the nation's wealthiest citizens have to pay in federal taxes. On that issue, polls find most voters in favor of letting the Bush-era tax cuts lapse for the wealthy while retaining tax cuts for families earning $250,000 and under annually. But a new report undertaken by the Tax Justice Network paints a disturbing picture of tax avoidance, finding that the super-rich in the U.S. and around the world are hiding at least $21 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding paying millions of dollars in taxes in their home countries. In the report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, the Tax Justice Network found that the wealth hidden in tax shelters is equivalent to the United States and Japanese economies combined. While the public is familiar with tax havens and banks located on far-off exotic islands, the report found that UBS, Credit Suisse, and Goldman Sachs are among the top private banks managing offshore accounts for the world's wealthiest people. The authors of the report, relying on data from the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations, central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, and other sources, concluded that the impact of unpaid taxes is staggering, where global financial inequality is much greater than originally estimated and growing. Your reporter spoke with the lead author of the report, James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company, who summarizes his investigation, tax cheating's effect on inequality, and how governments can reform banking regulations to recapture billions in lost tax revenue.
Well, the headline number is $21 trillion of offshore private financial wealth. That's bonds and stocks, as well as bank deposits on alternate investments like hedge funds. It doesn't include so-called non-financial assets like real estate, art collections, yachts, and intellectual property. There's an important offshore market there as well. You know, most of the City of London is actually owned offshore at this point through offshore companies. What we're focusing on here is just financial wealth. Much of this is concentrated in the hands of about 10 million people at most, around the planet, and the growth of the activity has been accounted for by a relative handful of major international banks, which have made it a business to help wealthiest people on the planet take their money out of their home countries, invest it abroad tax-free, and using a variety of schemes to defend it against taxation. The havens that we all hear about, the so-called treasure islands like the Caymans and Bermuda and the Bahamas and Panama and Jersey. These are really to be thought of mainly as conduits in this system. The real destination havens for this capital and the place it actually ends up being invested are the major financial centers of the world, New York, London, Zurich and Geneva, Belgium is another one, Liechtenstein. These are places that people actually end up investing their capital. Nobody wants to have their funds sitting in, you know, Tortola or Bahamas for very long. So they use shell companies that are registered in places like Cayman Islands or Bahamas, and then the ultimate investments are made in these major countries.
James, briefly, please tell our listeners a little bit about how these offshore tax havens contribute to income inequality in the United States particularly.
Well, I think if it's possible for the wealthy to basically go back to the 1920s and roll back the clock to the days before really progressive income taxation, you know, effectively legislating themselves a tax cut by taking funds offshore, you know, it's hard to reduce your tax rate below zero. You know, those practices are things that ordinary folks have a hard time keeping up with. So small business has a hard time, for example, taking advantage of the offshoring of intellectual property that companies like Google and Microsoft and Pfizer and other leading technology companies have used. They basically park their intellectual property in Bermuda or Ireland and then pay themselves royalties that are not taxed. And then they come back to the U.S. government and ask for a tax break when they repatriate all these profits they've offshored back to the United States. That's in the corporate world, and that's separate from the price of offshore revisited. We're talking there about corporate, and this is about individuals. But there's a lot of ways in which this haven architecture has been abused and affects the distribution of wealth. One of them is on the corporate side. On the individual side, you know, it's basically an invitation to the more aggressive members of the wealthiest class to hide money offshore and to not report it in the home country and basically avoid any tax burden at all. So effectively, there's a lot of Romneys out there, and he's just one of many folks, probably not even the most aggressive in terms of this practice.
What's been the reaction to this report, and are there any viable solutions here in terms of reining in these tax shelters through international treaties or such? I wish it was simple, but I'm sure it's not. You'll probably tell me that.
We've seen a tremendous response you know, from all over the globe. I mean, I've had inquiries from India and Russia, and journalists in Argentina. I mean, Chile, this is a global story. It's kind of unprecedented, the response we've had. And I've been studying this field since the 1980s. I mean, I wrote my first piece on this in 1986, and I have been waiting for, you know, any kind of interest on the part of policymakers. I think, you know, what to do about it, there are many things we can do to clamp down on the worst abuses, and we can have automatic information reporting, which the United States has with its friends in Canada and the UK, but it doesn't extend now to Mexico. The Mexican finance minister asked Tim Geithner to help share the same information on Mexican investors that he was giving to the Canadians, and they got no response. You know, that automatic information reporting on offshore earnings is an important step forward. I think regulating pirate banking and the kind of misbehavior of the big banks here is really something we ought to consider. And then it may be possible to get people to agree on a minimal tax while we're waiting for tougher enforcement. You know, that would just a 0.5% of what's parked in the banks now would generate enough to pay the entire foreign aid bill from the OECD. So at least we would get something from all the offshore tax evasion, the drug money, all the dirty money that's sitting in these offshore accounts while we're waiting for, you know, tighter enforcement.
That was James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company and lead author of the Tax Justice Network report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited. Find links to the report and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 28th, 45 persons walked onto the site of a mountaintop removal mine in Lincoln County in the southern West Virginia coalfields to demand an end to the practice in which the tops of Appalachian ridges are blasted apart to get to the coal seams beneath. It leaves behind what looks like a moonscape in many cases, with the blasted rocks and soil dumped in the valleys below. More than 2,000 miles of valley streams have been buried so far. Coal from mountaintop removal sites is a small but profitable part of coal production. Critics charge that the mountaintop removal coal mining process has contributed to increases in cancer and birth defects among the people living in surrounding communities. Dustin Steele is a West Virginian from the town of Blair, the site of a major protest in 2011 commemorating a 1921 march by miners demanding workers' rights. Steele is an organizer with the group Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, or RAMPS, which sponsored the civil disobedience protest action last week. He was one of 20 arrested and charged with trespassing and obstruction, both misdemeanors, but all those arrested were being held on $25,000 bail each. RAMPS reports that Steele was severely beaten while in police custody.
In an interview with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus before his arrest, Steele explains the relationship between the diminishing role of coal in powering the nation, local jobs, and the campaign to end America's dependence on fossil fuels.
People who are employed by the coal industry are seeing the rate of being employed by the coal industry drop. Layoffs is happening everywhere, and people are being scared, and rightfully so. And it's because of market conditions, but the coal companies need to blame it on something. So they blame it on out-of-state environmentalists. But for me and my account, the oppression that's happening here with extractive industries is happening all over the world. And you have to be fighting oppression whenever it takes form and wherever it takes shape. And I'm so glad there's so many people who just decide to dedicate their time to fight extractive industries here.
What's your sense? I mean, I know a lot of polls have showed among West Virginians that the majority is against mountaintop removal for whatever the reasons might be. What's your own personal opinion about underground mining? Do you think more people should be doing underground mining, or do you think coal mining, or do you think it would be better to leave it in the ground?
I think extraction is extraction. Whenever you take carbon-based non-renewables out of the ground, you are leading to the climate crisis. It's a non-sustainable way to create electricity and provide employment. I feel like there has to be a transition point, but it needs to start with mountaintop removal being over tomorrow and having a really steadfast plan to move away from coal. And I feel like we're to the point where if we don't start addressing the problems with our environment, it's going to be too big for human beings to fix ourselves. So we have to get away from coal mining as soon as possible.
It seems like the majority opinion in West Virginia is still in favor of coal because of the jobs, and I'm not sure what else. I guess just because of the jobs. Is that changing at all? Like, do you think there's very many people with your opinion?
That's impossible for me to quantify. I feel as there is a marked decrease in production of Appalachian coal, and that's going to continue as coal resources in the Powder River Basin and out west with pit mining and better technology that requires, that has less of a need for low sulfur coal, it's going to be the end of the Central Appalachian coal market anyways. So people are still dependent on this monolithic industry, but the fact is coal is leaving regardless of what we were doing or not. Like, the market isn't going to support coal in Central Appalachia for too much longer. And as that market continues to drop, and hopefully as we continue and become more steadfast and more efficient within our organizing, you'll see the dissenting voices of coal increase.
You're right in the middle of it. You're right in the middle of mountaintop removal. Have you or your family or your friends, neighbors, experienced any direct negative impacts from mountaintop removal mining?
Where I live, for a multitude of reasons, and like, this is coal mining in general, and not just mountaintop removal. The community I live, their water has been poisoned by continuous blasting. Everyone is on well water, and everybody's water. And the community I live in Blair, their water is poisoned. This is a process that's happening all over the place. I've seen my good friends of mine be diagnosed with cancer. Anybody who lives in southern West Virginia, whether they're aware of it or not, is negatively affected by mountaintop removal and, quite frankly, coal mining in general.
Dustin Steele, are you part of this group that, after the March on Blair Mountain last summer, there was a group that, I guess, stayed and formed an organization or a community group?
I am a member of the Blair Mountain Heritage Alliance. I work at the Blair Community Center and Museum. Our main objective within the community center is to keep instilling the fact that the community of Blair is still alive and, like, will continue the function, and also the museum venerating the history of Blair and why it's important not only to coal mining history, not only to labor and union history, but to the history of the middle class.
And just the last thing, this action that's coming up, where they're calling it a mass walk onto a mountaintop removal site, mining site, is being pitched as kind of the next step, as a step beyond what's been done so far. What do you hope this action will engender?
We're beginning to force the coal companies to react to us. And from that point, we're going to continue to use this process to make the coal companies start reacting to us. We're only moving forward. We're only going to build a stronger movement. And we're looking to stop mountaintop removal. And we're not going to lose, and we're not going to take no for an answer. We're going to end mountaintop removal.
That was Dustin Steele of the group RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival. For more information on the campaign to stop mountaintop removal coal mining, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Javier Cecilia's 24-year-old son was murdered with a group of friends by drug traffickers in the city of Cuernavaca last year, the well-known Mexican poet founded the Movement for Peace with Justice and Dignity to call for an end to the drug violence in his country. Over the past 6 years, Mexico's drug war has claimed the lives of 60,000 people, 10,000 have disappeared, and over 150,000 have been forced to leave their homes. As Cecilia, an essayist, novelist, and journalist, has called attention to the tragic fallout of the drug war, he has organized major protest caravans in Mexico's northern and southern regions. This summer, Cecilia, along with other victims of Mexico's drug war, will be leading a caravan through the U.S. with the goal of promoting a dialogue with American civil society and its government on the issues of gun trafficking, alternatives to drug prohibition, and finding better tools to combat money laundering. The Caravan for Peace with Justice and Dignity will be leaving San Diego on August 12th, visiting more than 24 cities on its way to Washington, D.C., where activists will arrive in mid-September. The caravan is being supported by 60 U.S. and Mexican organizations, including Global Exchange, the NAACP, Drug Policy Alliance, Labor Council for Latin American Advancement, and Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Your reporter spoke with Ted Lewis, Human Rights in Mexico Program Director with the international social justice group Global Exchange, who discusses the goals of this summer's Caravan for Peace.
What's been happening in Mexico over the last few years is an absolute disaster. The drug war that had been carried on throughout the hemisphere ever since President Nixon declared it a little more than 40 years ago has touched many other countries in the hemisphere in disastrous ways. A prime example is Colombia. But Mexico, until quite recently, had been a place where the drug business was carried on relatively quietly with a set of political arrangements that it made it not something that drew really the attention of the state. There was a kind of a collaboration, a wink-wink, if you will, and that all ended in 2006, when President Calderon came into power. It's a long and complicated, twisted road to how we got there, but when President Calderon decided to back up his highly questioned, possibly illegitimate election to the presidency of Mexico by launching a propaganda campaign that involved attacking the drug cartels, attacking the criminal organizations of the country, bringing the army out into the streets, using the military to attack a problem that was really a police problem with the judicial system and with high levels of impunity in the country, with historic collaboration between government and the profit centers of the drug industry. The army comes into that, is not properly equipped to actually handle a task like that, and escalates things dramatically. One thing they've been able to do is occasionally take down a top cartel leader, which has led to fratricidal kinds of readjustments, as they call them in Mexico. And in all of that, the Mexican population has been, not just the bystanders, but the bystanders, the victims of this conflict.
If you were to put in a nutshell, what is the message that's being sent by the folks that are going to be on this caravan for that month between August 12th and September 12th?
Well, the main group of people that's going to be at the heart of this caravan are what are known in Mexico as victims. these are all people who have lost close relatives, fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, sons, daughters, to the violence of the drug war. You know, they have many, many different stories. So people are coming across to address the fact that having the largest consumer of illicit drugs right next to them with a policy that says supposedly these drugs are illegal just creates a setup for the exact kind of misery that they're living in. To pursue a military approach to something that so clearly doesn't have that kind of a solution is to bring disaster. They also want to look at, you know, they want to raise some ancillary issues that are extremely important, like the traffic of assault weapons from the United States into Mexico, the principal route to the criminals being legally purchased guns in the United States, purchased under very liberal gun laws that allow virtually anyone to buy an almost unlimited amount of guns and ammunition, and without reporting that would make that a clear and easily tracked pattern. This is fueling a gun market into Mexico that's just, you know, out of control.
Well, Ted, as this caravan proceeds across the U.S., what are you going to be asking people who come out to find out what the message is? What can they do in terms of directly having some impact on the drug war in Mexico and here in the United States? What are they going to be asking people to do?
Well, we're going to be asking people to come out and try, first of all, to make some of the connections between the different aspects of the drug war and how it affects our communities. We feel like there's a sea change of attitude and opinion about the drug war that needs to be built into a real coalition for change. So what we're asking people to do is get together with their neighbors, talk about it, start thinking about alternatives. You know, there are a lot of different things people can do. There are petitions around the issue of weapons trafficking that the caravan is bringing with it, visibility campaigns around the whole question of the need for drug reform, drug policy reform. These are questions that inevitably will move slowly in a political fashion. So at this point, what we see happening with the kind of movement toward drug reform is that on an international level, the understanding of the futility of the drug war has really advanced.
That was Ted Lewis, Human Rights Program Director with Global Exchange. Read more about this summer's Caravan for Peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.